All right. Severance pay in Ontario. You know, it's something that I think everyone thinks about at some point in their careers. And you've sent us this guide, the Employment Standards Act from the Ontario government, specifically the section about severance. And honestly, it can be a bit of a maze.
Oh, yeah.
So we're going to map it out together so you know exactly what to expect if you're ever in this situation.
Absolutely. This is about understanding your rights
Yeah.
and knowing what to do if you're facing a job loss. It's about being prepared and empowered.
Yeah.
And we're going to make sure you have that knowledge.
Okay. So let's start with the scenario. Imagine you've been working at a company for, say, 6 years, and suddenly you're let go. Now, you've probably heard the terms termination pay and severance pay. What's the difference?
That's a great starting point. Termination pay is what you get for the notice period, the heads up your employer is legally required to give you before letting you go. It's essentially payment in lieu of working out that notice period. Severance pay, on the other hand, is extra compensation for the long-term impact of job loss, especially for employees who have been with a company for a significant period.
So it's kind of like acknowledging that losing a job after years of service isn't just about a few weeks of missed paychecks. It's about potentially having to start over, rebuild your career, and face financial uncertainty.
Exactly. Severance pay is intended to help bridge that gap and give you a financial cushion as you navigate that transition.
So in what situations does this severance pay actually come into play?
Well, the most obvious one is if your employer dismisses you without cause. But it also applies if you're laid off for an extended period, specifically 35 weeks or more within a 52-week period.
Oh, wow.
This is because such a layoff suggests a more permanent loss of your position.
So even if they say it's a temporary layoff, if it drags on for that long, it triggers severance pay.
That's right. And then there are situations like a business closure, where unfortunately your job simply ceases to exist.
And what about situations where you're not technically fired, but you feel like you're being forced out? I've heard the term constructive dismissal thrown around. What does that actually mean?
Constructive dismissal is a tricky one. It's essentially when your employer doesn't outright fire you, but makes significant changes to your job that make it untenable for you to stay.
Right.
Imagine a scenario where you're suddenly demoted, your responsibilities are drastically reduced, or your pay is significantly cut without a justifiable reason. Those are all examples of situations that could be considered constructive dismissal.
So even if you're technically the one resigning, if you can prove that you were essentially forced out due to your employer's actions, you might still be eligible for severance.
Exactly. And there's another interesting scenario mentioned in the document that involves resigning after you've already been given a termination notice.
Wait, so if they've already given you notice, but you decide to leave sooner, you can still get severance.
It's counterintuitive,
Wow.
yes. Let's say your employer gives you 8 weeks' notice, which is more than the statutory minimum required based on your length of service. If you find a new job and want to start right away, you can resign. But you still need to give your employer at least 2 weeks written in notice. And here's the catch. Your resignation needs to take effect within that statutory notice period, which is the minimum notice they were legally required to give you in the first place.
So it's like a balancing act between your own needs and those legal minimums. But why is this important for someone facing termination?
It's about knowing that you have options. You don't have to feel trapped or forced to stay in a job that's ending. You can take control of your own timeline. And as long as you follow those specific rules, you can still protect your right to severance pay.
Okay, so we know some of the situations where severance might be a factor, but how do you know if you actually qualify? Is everyone who gets let go entitled to this payout?
Not quite. There are a couple of key criteria you need to meet. First and foremost,
Mm-hmm.
you need to have worked for your employer for at least 5 years. This is a significant threshold.
So it's really about protecting those long-term employees, the ones who have invested a substantial part of their careers with the company.
That's right. The second criteria relates to the size and payroll of your employer. Either your employer needs to have a global payroll of at least $2.5 million, or they must have terminated the employment of at least 50 employees within a 6-month period due to a business closure.
So it's not just about your individual circumstances, it's also about the scale of the company.
Exactly. Both of those criteria need to be met for you to be eligible for severance pay in Ontario.
All right, so let's say you've been with the company for 6 years, they meet the criteria, and you're being let go. How do you actually calculate how much severance you should receive?
There's a specific formula outlined in the document, and it's based on your regular weekly earnings and your length of service.
So if someone has been there longer and earns more, they'd be entitled to a larger severance package.
That's the general idea.
Yeah.
The document gives some good examples to illustrate how this works in practice.
Let's unpack one of those examples.
Sure. Let's look at Susan. She regularly works 40 hours per week at $25 an hour. This means her regular weekly earnings are $1,000. By the end of her notice period, she'll have been employed for 7 years, 9 months, and 2 weeks.
Okay, so how do those numbers translate into a severance amount?
We take the number of full years she worked, which is 7, and add that to the number of complete months in her incomplete year, divided by 12. 9 months divided by 12 gives us 0.75. We add that to her 7 years, which is a 7.75.
Then we multiply that number by her weekly wage of $1,000.
Exactly. That gives Susan a total severance pay of $7,750.
That's a pretty substantial sum, especially when you're facing the uncertainty of job loss.
It is. And it highlights why understanding these calculations is so important. You need to make sure you're getting what you're legally entitled to. And remember, this formula applies to employees who are paid on a regular hourly or salaried basis. The document outlines a slightly different method for calculating severance for employees who are paid on a different basis, like commission, for example.
So they've got it covered for different pay structures.
Yes, they do. And this is where things can get a bit more complex, especially if your earnings fluctuate.
So it's always a good idea to refer back to the document or even seek clarification from the Ministry of Labor if you're unsure about how these calculations apply to your specific situation.
Absolutely. It's always better to be safe than sorry. Especially when it comes to your livelihood.
Okay, so we've done the math.
Right.
We know how much severance pay is owed. When should you actually receive that money? Is it a lump sum on your last day?
Not necessarily. Hmm. According to the ESA, your severance pay is due either 7 days after your employment ends or on your next regular payday, whichever comes later.
So it's fairly soon after you leave the company. But what if it's a significant amount? Can it be paid out in installments?
It can. Installment payments are possible with your written consent or the approval of the Director of Employment Standards.
So there's some flexibility there.
There is. But keep in mind that installment plans can't last for more than 3 years. And importantly, if your employer misses a scheduled payment, the entire remaining severance pay becomes due immediately.
That's good to know. So there are safeguards in place to protect employees.
Yeah.
Even if they agree to an installment plan.
Right. It's about striking a balance and making sure the process is fair for both parties.
Okay, this has been a really helpful overview of the basics. But as we all know, things aren't always so straightforward.
You're absolutely right. There are exceptions and exemptions to these rules. And that's where things can get a bit tricky.
And that's exactly what we'll be diving into in the next part of our deep dive. We'll unpack those exemptions, look at some real-world scenarios, and make sure you have all the knowledge you need to navigate these sometimes murky waters. So stay tuned.
Welcome back to our deep dive into severance pay in Ontario. In the last part, we tackled the basics, what severance pay is, when it applies, and how to calculate it. But, as we hinted at, the devil is often in the details.
That's right. We need to explore those exemptions. That can sometimes make things a bit less straightforward. The document itself even suggests reaching out to the Employment Standards Information Center for guidance.
Right.
Which tells you something about the potential for complexity.
It does. So let's unpack some of these. One that stood out to me was the exemption for employees who refuse reasonable alternative employment. What does that even mean in practice? Well, it's not as simple as your employer offering you any old job and expecting you to take it to forfeit severance. The new position has to be comparable to your previous role in terms of skills, responsibilities, and compensation. It wouldn't be considered reasonable to offer a senior manager a junior-level role with a significant pay cut, for example.
So they can't just try to shuffle you into a lesser position to avoid paying severance.
Exactly. The alternative employment has to be reasonable considering your experience, skills, and previous earnings. And it's not just about the job title. Factors like your location.commute and overall working conditions also come into play.
So there's a lot of room for interpretation. What if you and your employer disagree about whether the alternative employment is actually reasonable?
And that's where open communication is crucial. Start by having a conversation with your employer, clearly outlining your concerns and why you believe the alternative offer isn't suitable. If you can't reach a resolution through discussion, you might want to consider mediation. or even seek legal advice.
Okay, so it's about knowing your worth and advocating for yourself. You don't have to just accept whatever is offered.
Exactly. And it's important to document everything. Keep records of conversations, emails, and any written offers of alternative employment. This will be helpful if you need to escalate the matter or seek legal advice later on.
All right, let's move on to another exemption that I'm still a bit unclear about. Resigning after receiving a termination notice. We talked about the basics earlier, but it still feels a bit counterintuitive.
It is a bit of a head-scratcher at first. The ESA recognizes that even after an employer initiates termination, the employee might have reasons to leave before the official end date.
Like maybe they've already found a new job and don't want to wait out the notice, period.
Exactly. Or they might have personal circumstances that require them to leave sooner. The key here is that the employee can still be entitled to severance, even if they resign. But there are conditions.
Right. We talked about the 2 weeks written notice, but what was that other crucial detail?
The resignation must take effect during what's called the statutory notice period. This is the minimum notice an employer is legally required to give based on the employee's length of service. So if you've worked for a company for 6 years, your employer must provide at least 6 weeks' notice of termination.
So even if they give you 8 weeks' notice, you need to make sure your resignation falls within those 6 weeks that are legally mandated.
Precisely. It's a technicality. But it's crucial for preserving your right to severance. If you resign outside of that statutory notice period, you might forfeit that entitlement.
Okay, so timing is everything in this situation.
It really is. It's about understanding those legal timelines and making sure your actions align with them.
This leads to a question I had about something else we discussed earlier, the 5-year rule. What if someone is close to that 5-year mark when they're let go?
That's a great question. And it's a situation where seeking legal advice is highly recommended. There have been cases where employees who were just shy of the 5-year mark were still awarded severance pay, especially if they could demonstrate that their termination was in bad faith or that they had a reasonable expectation of continued employment.
So it's not always a hard and fast rule. There's some gray area there.
There is. And that's where having a strong legal advocate can make all the difference.
Okay, let's talk about retiring on a full pension. I can see how that might be an exemption as your income is theoretically taken care of.
Right. The logic is that if you're walking away with a comfortable retirement income, you might not need that additional financial support from severance pay. But it's important to note that this exemption only applies to very specific situations.
What do you mean?
The pension has to be a full pension that takes into account all the years of service you would have accumulated if you had worked until your planned retirement date. It's not just any pension plan. It has to be one that fully covers your expected earnings for those remaining years.
So if you are planning to work for another 5 years, but you're let go now, your pension would have to cover those 5 years of lost income for this exemption to apply.
Exactly. And it's important to remember that Canada Pension Plan benefits don't count toward this exemption. CPP is a basic safety net for all Canadians, not a replacement for a company pension plan.
Okay, that makes sense. What about situations where the company itself shuts down? Are all employees automatically entitled to severance in a business closure?
Unfortunately, it's not that simple. The rules around severance pay in cases of business closures can be quite complicated. First of all, the closure has to be permanent. If it's a temporary shutdown, different rules might apply.
And even if it is permanent, there are still some hoops to jump through, right?
Yes. The document outlines two main scenarios where severance would be triggered. Either your employer needs to have a global payroll of at least $2.5 million, or they must have terminated the employment of at least 50 employees within a 6-month period because of the closure.
So it's a double whammy. Not only do you lose your job, but you also need your employer to meet these specific criteria to qualify for severance.
It is a difficult situation.
Yeah.
And it highlights the importance of understanding these nuances.
Yeah.
And there's another exception that can come into play in cases of business closures, which relates to strikes.
What do you mean?
If the business closure is a direct result of the economic fallout from a strike, employees might not be eligible for severance pay.
So if a prolonged strike essentially cripples the company and forces them to shut down, employees might lose out on severance.
It's a complex situation with a lot of legal gray areas. It would likely involve a careful examination of the circumstances surrounding the closure to determine whether the strike was the primary cause.
Okay, let's move on to an exemption that seems pretty straightforward. Willful misconduct. If you're fired for doing something intentionally wrong, you shouldn't expect severance pay, right?
That's the general idea. This exemption is designed to protect employers from having to compensate employees who are deliberately harming the company or engaging in serious misconduct.
So we're not talking about showing up late or forgetting to file a report. It's about intentional actions that violate company policies or even break the law.
Exactly. Things like theft, fraud, violence in the workplace, or consistently violating safety protocols despite repeated warnings would fall under this category.
But if you're fired for something that was a genuine mistake or an oversight, that wouldn't qualify as willful misconduct.
Correct. It has to be a deliberate act of wrongdoing to disqualify you from severance pay. The employer would need to prove that the misconduct was intentional and that it warranted dismissal.
This seems fair. It's about accountability on both sides.
It is. Both employers and employees have responsibilities.
Yeah.
And these exemptions reflect that.
Okay. We've covered a lot of ground here. It's clear that these exemptions can have a big impact on whether or not you're entitled to severance. What's the most important thing for someone facing this situation to remember?
Don't just assume anything. Don't assume you automatically qualify. And don't assume you're automatically disqualified. Gather all the relevant information. Carefully review your options. And if there's any doubt, seek professional advice to make sure you understand your rights and make informed decisions.
Great advice. And speaking of professional advice, in the final part of our deep dive, we'll shift gears and explore what happens when those ESA minimums aren't enough. We'll delve into the world of wrongful dismissal lawsuits and what you need to know if you believe you've been treated unfairly. So stay tuned.
Welcome back to the final part of our deep dive into severance pay in Ontario. We've covered a lot of ground, from the basics of calculating those weeks of pay to understanding the nuances of exemptions. Now let's shift gears and explore what happens when the ESA's minimum standards just don't cut it.
That's right. Sometimes the situation goes beyond just the numbers. There might be feelings of unfair treatment, broken promises, or even a sense that your dismissal was downright unjust.
Exactly. It can feel like more than just losing a job. It can feel like a breach of trust. And that's where the concept of wrongful dismissal comes in. It's a legal avenue that allows employees to seek additional compensation or remedies that go beyond what the ESA guarantees.
So it's like taking your case to a higher court, so to speak.
In a way, yes. Wrongful dismissal lawsuits typically play out in civil court, and they're based on the idea that the employer breached their contractual obligations or acted in bad faith when terminating the employment relationship.
It's not just about the money. It's about holding employers accountable for their actions.
Precisely. It can be about seeking justice, clearing your name, or even setting a precedent to protect other employees from similar treatment.
What are some examples of situations that might lead someone to consider a wrongful dismissal lawsuit?
One common scenario is when an employee is dismissed without cause and given a severance package that's significantly less than what they believe they're entitled to, based on their years of service, their position, and industry norms. It's not just about meeting those minimum ESA requirements. It's about what's considered fair and reasonable in the context of their career.
So experience and contributions to the company play a role.
Absolutely. Another situation might involve an employee who has promised a certain level of job security or a specific career path, only to have those promises broken abruptly without justification.
It's about those unwritten agreements and expectations that can sometimes carry more weight than what's formally stated in a contract.
Exactly. And sometimes wrongful dismissal cases stem from situations where the employee feels they were targeted or discriminated against, leading to their termination. It becomes about more than just lost income. It's about addressing issues of fairness and respect in the workplace.
It sounds like these cases can be pretty complex and emotionally charged.
They can be. And that's why it's crucial to have the right support and guidance.
Okay. Let's say someone believes they have a strong case for wrongful dismissal. What are the first steps?
The most important step is to consult with an employment lawyer who specializes in wrongful dismissal cases. They can assess the merits of your claim, explain the process, and guide you through each step.
So finding the right legal representation is crucial.
Absolutely. A good lawyer will help you gather evidence, build a strong case, and navigate the complexities of employment law. They'll also be able to advise you on the potential risks and benefits of pursuing a lawsuit.
What kind of evidence is typically used in these cases?
It varies depending on the situation. But common types of evidence include employment contracts, performance reviews, emails, internal company documents, and even witness testimonies from colleagues or supervisors. Anything that can help paint a clear picture of the employment relationship, the circumstances surrounding the dismissal, and any actions or behaviors that might support the claim of wrongful dismissal.
So it's about building a narrative that supports your claim.
Exactly. And it's important to be organized and thorough in documenting everything.
Okay. You've consulted a lawyer, gathered evidence. What happens next? Is it straight to court?
Not necessarily. Before things escalate to a full-blown court battle, there's usually an attempt to resolve the dispute through negotiation or mediation.
So there's a chance to settle things amicably without going to trial.
Yes. And in fact, many wrongful dismissal cases are settled out of court. Your lawyer will communicate with the employer's legal team, present your demands, and try to reach a mutually agreeable solution. This can save both parties time, money, and the stress of a trial.
But what if those negotiations break down?
If a settlement can't be reached, then you might have to proceed with filing a lawsuit and going to court. This is where things can get more formal, time-consuming, and expensive.
So it's not a decision to be taken lightly?
Definitely not. Going to court should be seen as a last resort, but sometimes necessary to ensure your rights are protected and that you receive the compensation you deserve.
What kind of outcomes can people expect from a wrongful dismissal lawsuit?
Well, if you're successful, the court might award you various remedies, including back pay for lost wages, compensation for the reasonable notice period you should have received, damages for the emotional distress and reputational harm caused by the dismissal, or even punitive damages to punish the employer for particularly egregious conduct. In some cases, they might even order your reinstatement to your former position.
So the outcomes can range from financial compensation to actually getting your job back.
Exactly. The specific remedies awarded will depend on the nature of the wrongful dismissal, the severity of the employer's actions, and the impact it had on your life and career.
It's important to remember that the ESA and wrongful dismissal lawsuits are two distinct paths.
Yes.
Yeah.
You can't pursue both simultaneously. If you file a claim with the Ministry of Labor for ESA termination or severance pay, you forfeit your right to sue for wrongful dismissal.
So it's a crucial decision point. Do you stick with the ESA's minimum standards, or do you go for a potentially bigger payout but with more risk and complexity?
Exactly. There's no right or wrong answer. It depends on your individual circumstances.
Yeah.
The strength of your case.
Yeah.
Your risk tolerance and your overall goals. It's a decision best made in consultation with a knowledgeable employment lawyer.
This deep dive into severance pay and wrongful dismissal has been incredibly insightful. We've gone from the basics of calculating weeks of pay to the complexities of legal battles. If there's one key takeaway for our listeners, it's that knowledge is power.
Absolutely. Understanding your rights, knowing the resources available to you, and seeking professional advice when needed can make all the difference in navigating these challenging situations.
And remember, this is just a starting point. Employment law is constantly evolving, so staying informed is crucial. Don't hesitate to reach out to those resources we've mentioned throughout this deep dive, or consult with an employment lawyer to get personalized guidance for your specific situation.
It's always better to be prepared and to advocate for yourself effectively.
Thanks for joining us on this deep dive. We'll see you next time for another exploration of a topic that matters to you.